Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at the National Campus and Community Radio Conference, taking place on unceded Coast Salish territories at CFUV Radio at the University of Victoria, British Columbia. We're your hosts,
Jana Juniper G from CFUV,
and Elizabeth Jager from Cortez Island Community Radio CKTZ 89.5 FM. In this edition, we'll feature reflections on the Resonating Reconciliation Project and live audio from the Red Jam Slam. We will also take an in-depth look at the effects of the Morgenthaler Clinic closure and a detention review boycott currently taking place in maximum security prisons in Ontario. First, here are the headlines.
Groundwire's new national coordinator, Rachel Swatek, has brought us this story. Canadian sex trade workers and advocates are speaking out against a tough new prostitution bill. The Supreme Court struck down Canada's prostitution laws in December 2013 as unconstitutional because they endangered sex trade workers. Justice Minister Peter MacKay says the new law targets johns and pimps. However, sex workers could face jail time for selling sexual services anywhere children under 18 years old may be present. Emily Simons is the chair of POWER, Prostitutes of Ottawa Gatineau Work, Educate and Resist, an Ottawa-based advocacy group. She says the potential for criminal charges will make it harder for sex workers to protect themselves.
And we know that sex workers who are working on the streets protect themselves in three key ways. They protect themselves by taking the time to screen a client and looking at a bad date list before jumping into a vehicle. They work in groups or in pairs where they can take down license plates and watch out for each other. Mm-hmm. And they work in well-lit and well-populated areas where if they scream, someone will hear them. And when sex workers and their clients fear being criminally charged, sex workers stop working in groups and in pairs. They stop working in well-lit and well-populated areas, and they stop screening their clients because doing these things can put them at increased risk of being arrested and criminally charged.
Simons says she believes sex work should be decriminalized so that sex workers feel safe going to police.
So we already have laws to protect sex workers. We have laws against physical assault, against sexual assault, against underage prostitution, against human trafficking, and these laws are sufficient to protect sex trade workers. The problem is that sex workers don't feel comfortable approaching the police and having the violence against them taken seriously.
The bill is under debate in the House of Commons. On June 14th, sex workers and their allies will be taking to the streets in protest of this legislation in cities from coast to coast for the second annual National Day of Action in solidarity with sex workers.
Resonating Reconciliation is a project that engages community radio to help people reconcile with the history of the Indian residential schools. Indigenous broadcasters and producers at 40 community radio stations from coast to coast produce documentaries about the legacy of the residential schools. Project coordinator Gennardio Sullivan facilitated a workshop at the NCRC reflecting on and celebrating the Resonating Reconciliation Project.
About two or three years ago, it was recognized by the membership that we needed more First Nations representatives at this conference and that we were having difficulty bringing them. Stations didn't know how to engage First Nations people at their station, and First Nations people didn't know how to approach stations either to come on board. So it was at that time that we had a strategic meeting and we decided that we were going to make that a priority, and we did. We applied for the TRC grant, and here we all are celebrating Resonating Reconciliation through communication. It's been a really great journey. You may remember me when it first started and how it seemed like I felt like I was going through a lot of struggles, and as I was trying to understand myself and the residential school experience on our people. And I feel a lot stronger now that we've done this work. It's been hard work, and I feel a lot better about myself, about my community, about my own family. And I think that's what the work is all about. And I also feel really great about this relationship that we've built with over 40 stations and over 40 First Nations broadcasters, because sometimes stations brought on one or two or three producers into their station to do this hard work, and we've done it together. There's nothing like that. It's a perfect match.
Courtney Harrop, the volunteer coordinator at CGMP in Powell River, shared some of the things that she learned in the process.
We organized and facilitated a listening celebration in the Sliamon community, and so then went through the process of learning about protocols and recognition and who speaks, and it was a lengthy and amazing process. I learned so much, and I'm still learning so much.
Jesse Dubois won the NCRA's Nesky Manual Award for Aboriginal Affairs and Culture for the resonating reconciliation documentary he produced at CJSW called Education and the Indian Residential Schools. Log on to the Resonating Reconciliation page on the NCRA website and listen to the documentaries produced by Indigenous broadcasters from coast to coast. I'm Carly Forbes, reporting from the NCRC in Victoria for Groundwire.
Our next headline comes to us from Julian Nuzieli from CHRW in London about a low-frequency hum coming from south of the border whose source was recently identified.
A mysterious sound known as the Windsor Hum has been traced to an island in the Detroit River, according to a report released today. The noise has been plaguing Windsor for as much as 3 years. Not everyone in Windsor is able to hear it, but those who can describe it as an intermittent, very low-pitched sound. The sound has been traced to Zug Island on the American side of the border. The island is home to a steel mill, which is suspected to be related to the sound. However, Canadian scientists have still been unable to pinpoint the exact spot from which the sound originates. CHRW spoke to Meg Roberts, a reporter for CJAM in Windsor, about the hum.
They can't peg the exact location. They think that it's coming from a blast furnace at U.S. Steel. That's likely the source, but they don't want to jump to conclusions yet, so that hasn't been proven. But they are trying to pin the location, but it's a difficult task, and kind of in order for this to proceed any further, they're going to need the cooperation and support from the Detroit side.
The hum has reportedly caused sleep loss, headaches, and even rattling windows. Part of the difficulty in tracing the sound is due to the low frequency, Roberts said.
I'm not an expert on this, but I don't think that you can go and just hear it because it's a really low frequency. So I think even standing next to this machine or this plant or whatever this happens to be, I don't think that you can actually hear it, like, as if it was loud.
Right, so it's not just as if it was a bang coming from a machine.
No, it's more of a humming. Like, people are calling it kind of like an idling car. Like, it's not something particularly loud. It's almost like a buzzing.
For CHRW, I'm Julian Uzieli.
British Columbia's 40th Parliament came to a close with some excitement when opposition agricultural critic Nicholas Simons was ejected for using unparliamentary language.
You are a bunch of liars. You're a bunch of corrupt liars.
Member, you need to withdraw.
You all know it too.
Member, you need to withdraw.
Everybody knows. I will not withdraw my remarks.
Those remarks came as BC's Liberal government pushed through their controversial Bill 24. Which many feel effectively removes the independence of the Land Commission and erodes the protection of BC farmlands. Simons discussed the incident the following day with CJMP programmer Karen Skadsheim on their weekly segment, What's Up Down in Victoria.
From the Alberni Valley News, it says here, quote, "You're all a bunch of corrupt liars," end quote, shouted NDP agriculture critic Nicholas Simons before he stormed out of the chamber as time ran out.
I think I strutted. Well, they can't write that, you know. They have to say stormed. I was upset, and I was perhaps intemperate in some of my remarks.
Simons was then escorted from the chamber, but returned later and withdrew those intemperate remarks so he could cast his vote against the bill. Established in 1973, BC's Land Commission was the first of its kind in Canada. At the time, rampant urbanization threatened an estimated 4,000 to 6,000 hectares of prime agricultural land per year in a province with what can only be classified as challenging geography. The ALC set aside just 5% of BC's total land and has preserved it for farm use for over 40 years. Bill 24 divides the ALR into two unequally sized zones. The restrictions on a majority of the reserve, Zone 2, have been relaxed to allow non-farm uses, and many fear this opens a door for large-scale development.
We have resolutions from local governments representing 4 million people in the province saying we don't want this legislation. But the government listened to nobody.
While people protested and took action against Bill 24, it was ultimately passed by the majority Liberal government. Simons and other critics of the bill say it weakens food security during a period where other communities are strengthening it. They also say that BC's Liberal government has not had adequate or meaningful consultation with affected parties.
That headline was produced for Groundwire by Karen Skadsheim and Courtney Harrop from CJMP.
Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature was produced by Mino Ramos of CFRU in Guelph. A historic coordinated boycott of detention review hearings by jailed migrants in three different Ontario maximum security prisons is taking place. Migrant people imprisoned in Lindsay, Toronto, and Penetanguishene are boycotting their detention review hearings for 30 days starting on June 2nd. Statements of participating prisoners were recorded by phone.
We're talking about immigration detention reviews and the adjudication processes. And, well, what the adjudication process is, it determines whether a person, a migrant, would be released within 30 days or be detained for the next 30 days pending deportation. I myself have been through this. The way the system is set up is that 30 days, every 30 days you go in. It's supposed to be a public hearing, but I guess there's a Minister of Public Safety representative, and then the adjudicator from the Immigration Refugee Board, and then the detainee. They look at each and every individual's case, and some of these people come from different places where the countries are not just accepting them.
I'm boycotting June 2nd. My detention hearing, because every time I go there, it's like they already made up their mind. Doesn't matter what I say, the outcome is dangerous to the public and flight risk. Come back in 30 days.
I've been on immigration all since May the 30th, 2012. I keep going to the detentions, and I keep hearing the same argument every time I go to the detention, that I'm a danger to the public and I'm a flight risk. It's very frustrating. I have two kids here. I've been here since 2006.
They keep telling me I'm fighting risk. Well, meanwhile, I'm not fighting risk for anything or anybody. I didn't commit any crime. I've been living in this country for 25 years, working hard, taxpayer, good to the community, blood donor, taxpayers. I never abused or taken advantage of the Canadian generosity in my whole time here in this country. I didn't even use an OHIP. I didn't have any unemployment income, just working hard and pay tax. And now, as a way, every time I go to my review, every time they tell me, fighting risk, just the same answer, and they have no heart at all the way they talk to you. And I am in maximum security jail. I decided I'm not going to ask any help. Know nothing about human rights here.
I went to my detention review the 26th of Monday. I came from Somalia and came here as a conventional refugee. And I've been in Canada for 15 years now. And I have no violence record. And since I've been going to my immigration hearing, saying that I have to sign a piece of paper to say that I give up my refugee status so that they can deport me, because without me signing that piece of paper, they can't deport me to Somalia, because we don't have no government, no embassy for them to put a traveling document. So they keep, every time I go to court, they say I'm not cooperating. How am I going to cooperate with them while what I'm doing is I'm going to sign out my rights? So from now on, I'm not going to go to any other detention review until my situation changes or until they stop giving us the paper to sign.
Canada is one of the few countries in the West that detains immigrants indefinitely, and some people have been detained for as many as 10 years. In September 2014, immigration detainees in Central East Correctional Center started a hunger strike, with two detainees staying on it for 65 days. In retaliation, immigration enforcement has deported some key strike organizers, released a few, moved others into prisons across Ontario, and locked up hunger strikers in segregation. Yet, strike actions like this boycott are continuing.
Louis Zatzman from CHMA brings us our next feature with an in-depth discussion of the closure of the Morgenthaler Clinic in Fredericton and what this means for abortion access for people living on the East Coast.
Dr. Elaine Naylor, Tasia Alexopoulos, thank you guys so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having us.
We're glad to be here.
We're talking today about the closure of the Morgenthaler Clinic in Fredericton. Before we get into the critical issues, would one of you mind taking me through the sort of the chronology of what happened?
He was giving a great deal of the funding to the clinic, and after his passing, the estate couldn't keep up the kinds of payments that he was able to give. And so that combined with kind of a long-term deficit, it's not a profit organization. New Brunswick, Nova Scotia PEI region is unique in the fact that there was only the one private clinic. And so with the loss of the clinic, there is actually very few options for women to obtain abortions now in the region.
What options remain?
In New Brunswick, the difficulty is that the abortion has to be deemed medically necessary by two separate doctors for women to access the abortion. Then for it to be covered by Medicare, which is also under the Canada Health Act, it has to be performed in a hospital by a gynecologist.
As professionals, or really taking any other skin you'd like with which to answer this question, would you say New Brunswick is providing adequate accessibility to abortions to women?
No.
No.
That didn't
basically
take very long. No.
No.
In the end, what it becomes is a class or income issue, which it was even before. Even to go to Morgenthaler, of course, you had to pay, but you had to get there to Fredericton from wherever. You had to stay overnight in a hotel or with a friend if you had somebody you could stay with. You needed somebody to drive you back home. So it was a 24-hour trip with a great deal of expense. And I did make that trip with a friend, you know, to drive her back from Fredericton. And I remember thinking at the time, what would a 13-year-old girl who might be afraid of telling her parents or might not have the resources, or what do you do if you're not middle class and with an income?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that New Brunswick in particular has placed a lot of difficult barriers for women to overcome in order to access their right to abortion. Having to see two different doctors, as Elaine mentioned, is very difficult in a province where many people don't have family doctors. You hear a lot of stories and anecdotes about people who have a doctor, but whose doctor isn't pro-choice or won't give them information about birth control. You hear a lot of stories about women being denied birth control by their family doctors in New Brunswick. And so when your right to abortion is being determined by someone who maybe doesn't have the same ideas about what women's rights are in Canada and in New Brunswick, then the province is really dropping the ball on ensuring that women do have access to that service, that they're entitled to.
Clearly, even when the Morgenthaler Clinic in Fredericton was open, there were issues. In a perfect world, what would need to be done by the government for somebody, let's say in Sackville, to be able to have free and accessible abortions?
Liberalize the provincial legal code or the laws or whatever it is that requires two doctors, medical reason. That is so restrictive.
You should be able to go to a hospital in whatever town you live in and receive an abortion. And that also means training doctors in universities and medical schools to perform the procedure, which is declining across the country.
To end off on a positive note, how can an individual really engage with the option for more accessible abortions to women.
For lack of a better word, one of the positive outcomes of this situation is that we're seeing a lot of engagement, actually, especially amongst young women. Women on campus here at Mount Allison are very angry about this. I think that there's this idea often that Canada is a place where women are equal to men and we have equal rights and equal access to services. And I think this really showed a lot of people otherwise, and that in their own home province, you know, a lot of them are from Fredericton, that something like this was happening so close to home and impacted them, their families, so intimately.
The struggles for women's rights really never end.
Tasia Alexopoulos, Dr. Elaine Naylor, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alicia Williams from CIVL produced our next feature with highlights from the Red Jam Slam with live recordings by Courtney Harrop of CJMP.
The Red Jam Slam Society was founded on June 10, 2010. They exist to host events, celebrations, and annual festivals that showcase both up-and-coming and veteran Aboriginal artists and performers. The Society maintains an inclusive mandate that honors all Aboriginal voices and encourages everyone to participate with continued growth, presence, and expression within all media. The Red Jam Slam was at the brand new First Peoples Ceremonial Hall on Friday, June 6, on the University of Victoria's campus on the traditional territory of the Lekwungen and Esquimalt people for the 2014 National Campus Community Radio Conference, hosted by CFUV, which took place last week. The featured performers were Standing Nation Drum, Victoria's Poet Laureate and CFUV's very own Native Waves host, Janet Rogers, local Coast Salish hip-hop group, Paint the Town Red, as well as South American, Vancouver-based freestyler and CJSF volunteer, LT Kama.
I just have to say how grateful I am for May and for the work that we're able to do with the blessings of May and her family and the Coast Salish people here on this territory. Believe me, without their blessings, we wouldn't be able to do any of this stuff. So, May, if you wouldn't mind to open and somewhat close for us tonight, please. Thank you.
You know, it's been a long week for a lot of you, and I really want to say hi to them. Thank you for every day that you've been here to take care of you, and as you travel home, it's a really wonderful blessing that you're going to be able to go home and be with your family. Hi,
Janet Rogers, a Mohawk writer from the Six Nations Band in Southern Ontario, was both the MC and a performing artist at Victoria's Red Jam Slam. She's the host of Native Waves on CFUV and has been the Poet Laureate of Victoria since 2012. While holding her position of Poet Laureate, she has created many opportunities for the community of Victoria to come together and celebrate poetic voices on the traditional lands of the Coast Salish people.
The drums are sounding, the women are coming, and we're not asking, we're telling. Our place is on the land, in front, on our feet, leading, let's go. So, I'm told, the black ones hold the gift of music, the yellow ones know how to heal. The red ones have been caretakers of this land forever and ever. And the white ones keep talking. Time and land are face opposite directions, looking backwards towards the west where everything is sung into being. We are born from song, so keep singing, keep breathing the melodies that made you. I am bringing ways of my land to your liquid thresholds. Hold on, let's go. Happiness is a song sung on the land by those who know it.
Now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report with voices from the 2014 National Campus and Community Radio Conference in Victoria.
The 2014 National Campus and Community Radio Association Conference brought broadcasters together to share ideas.
Here are some of the voices that attended.
Gennarji O'Sullivan hosted a session on resonating reconciliation. The series of 40 documentaries crafted by First Nations producers examined the legacy of the Indian residential schools across the country.
Station managers and these new producers, they now have built these new relationships, you know, that are based on respect and based on awareness. It's amazing to think that this hasn't happened naturally, because, you know, every campus has an Aboriginal student association. They're right there at your fingertips, and I just think it's been good in aiding both producers again and the station managers in finding each other.
Johnny Regalado, program director at the host station of CFUV, chaired the Technical Caucus, a group of people that create the magic behind the scenes of community radio.
Tech always likes to think big, but what we've decided is to create a forum and discussion space where everybody that is tech-minded or not so tech-minded can come together on the NCRA website and discuss all the different technology needs, and specifically logging and paperless play sheets and automation and things like that.
Laith Marouf from CKUT Montreal and Cactus Community Television Association urged people to turn their radio stations into multimedia hubs.
I had presented a workshop at the NCRC to help, on the one hand, the community radio stations be able to produce this multimedia content, video and radio, which will help them attract more traffic online, but also to help the communities in Canada that lack community television in general to produce video content.
Freya Zaltz, the legal advisor for the NCRA, talked about how stations should interact with the federal broadcasting regulator, the CRTC.
The CRTC is going to be looking for arguments that help them decide on the best use of spectrum. And so stations need to be really, they need to get the CRTC to decide in their favor based on the merits of what they're proposing.
Freya told the broadcasters to be cautious. But the keynote speaker for the awards gala, Rob Egan, had different advice.
Take risks. There's a big appetite out there for people that want to hear new music and they want to hear new ideas.
The 2014 NCRC took place in Victoria, hosted by CFUV-FM.
Reporting for Groundwire from the National Community Radio Conference, I'm Frieda Worden.
And I'm Ed von Attercass.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CFUV Radio in Victoria, thanks for tuning in. I'm Jana G. Juniper.
And I'm Elizabeth Jager.
Headlines this week were written by Karen Skadshin, Rachel Swatek, Julian Nuzili, and Megan Thomas. We also thank Carly Forbes, Gretchen King, Nina Halliday Thompson, Ed von Attercass, Frieda Weirden, Alicia Williams, Mina Ramos, Louis Zatzman, and Courtney Harrop, and the staff and volunteers at CFUV Radio. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.